here on the ILC, the go-to place for New York Islanders hockey talk.
Welcome aboard the ILC podcast. Mike Carver here with you as we are just about set for the Christmas holiday, the new year. Holiday times are upon us. And the Islanders are riding a three-game win streak as they look to close out the pre-Christmas road trip in Vegas and Dallas. Also today, we're going to have Nick Hirshon, author of We Want Fish Sticks. He'll join me in studio to talk about the book. As always, you can listen to us on all the normal places, iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and of course the homepage, ILSeat.com. Rate, review, five stars, as many stars as you can leave. Do all that good stuff for us as well. The sponsors, as always, 3J's Auto and Customs, Santorini Restaurant, Oakwood Automation, Bright Building Services. They take care of us. Please take care of them. Big show lined up today. Like I said, we're going to talk to Nick Hirshon later on. I had a really long, lengthy conversation with him about his book, We Want Fish Sticks. I'll tell you now, this is going to be a abnormally long episode of the ILC podcast because me and Nick sat down in the studio. We just kept talking about the Islanders of the mid-90s, a little bit about today, and I couldn't take any of it away, so I had to leave it all there. You'll hear that later on in this episode. I will see how time permits. I might, later on in this show, have a little recap of the Vegas game. Depends on what time that game finishes up. But let's talk about what's going on lately. The Islanders, of course, they're riding high right now. Three-game winning streak going into that Vegas game. It's been a fun little trip so far, that's for sure. Back-to-back nights in Colorado and Arizona. Josh Hosang has burst onto the scene now. He's played three games. He's got a goal. And the coach says it looks like he ain't going anywhere if he keeps playing the way he does. Thomas Hickey, of course, is hurt. So Devon Taves is going to show up. He's not going to play, I believe, tonight in Vegas. He'll probably make his debut Sunday down in Dallas. We'll see what happens with that. Getting to the Yote win, I went into that game on Tuesday night not expecting much off the second leg of a back-to-back. But, man, they showed you a lot of heart. They had a couple of guys banged up. Brock really showing you something. I mean, huge, huge props to Brock Nelson. Has this been a different year for Brock or what? At least with the way you hear me talk about Brock, you know it's a different year. Getting back out there on Tuesday night, because he took, I know it wasn't directly knee on knee Monday night in Colorado. We saw after the fact that it was more a little bit above that. But still, he was hurting. And to get himself ready to get in that game on Tuesday night, huge for the Islanders. They needed him. And he performed. Not only he gets in there, he scores a goal. So nice job by Brock helping out the cause Tuesday night. I've been slowly raising how much I have praised Brock Nelson this year. Him getting back out there after getting hurt Monday night and playing Tuesday, that was big for me. Showed me a lot. Showed me some toughness. Josh Hosang, what can you say? What can you say? Hosang is getting a chance right now, and he is taking full advantage of it. Here's the interesting things that I saw with Hosang Tuesday night in Arizona. One, how great was that goal? Crazy angle, beautiful shot, top of the net, maybe a little lucky. No, Ryan Pulock thought so in the first intermission interview. Funny. Usually the guy that scores does that interview. Kind of noticed it wasn't Hosang, but I think that that's probably by design, you could say. And then you saw him after the game, the post-game interview with Hosang, praising all the guys, not saying too much about himself, talked about how he's changing to a more defensive system, praised Komarov for how he helped him out during the game. And you've heard that a lot this year. A lot of guys praising Komarov for things that they're doing on and off the ice. Another guy does it, Hosang, on Tuesday night after that game. But I thought that it was a big night for Josh. And then the cherry on top for him was Trotz after the game saying, he's given us a reason to not send him back. Paraphrasing, of course. It was something along those lines. Josh continues to do what he's doing. He is not going anywhere. And that's something that you want to hear. Because I know that I sat here last week, and I've had bad luck with Josh Hosang. There's no question about that. In the prediction department, if you want to say. A couple years ago, before he showed up and started playing, me and B-Comp had the thing where I said, he's not playing for the Islanders. I'll be surprised if he ever plays for him. Boom, he shows up. He plays the entire second half of the season. Last week, I tell you, I think he's just here for for them to get a feel for him. I don't think he's going to play. Boom, he gets in the lineup on Saturday night. I've had some bad luck with Josh Hosang, not going to lie. So I'm out of the Josh Hosang prediction business for the time being. You're not going to hear me talking about making predictions on what Josh Hosang is going to do because I always end up getting burned. But great job by Josh in all three games. Didn't play that much in the Detroit game, but what he did in Colorado and in Arizona. How about in Colorado with the double penalty, which was an absolute joke? A joke that was. We'll get to the Colorado game in a moment, but the double penalty, the double minor, two in a row that the ref called on Hosang. One was a dive. One was barely a penalty. That's the kind of thing in the past would have got him in trouble, but he fought back from it, played well in the game, gets the opportunity the next night, boom, scores a goal. He's playing really well, and he's adding a lot of juice to the third line, which the Islanders need right now in the worst way. It's helping them out. I thought that Leonard really bounced back in the Arizona game. That goal he allowed in the first period was awful. Awful. I know some people wanted to blame Pelech for the goal. I can get that, but it's still a puck that Leonard has to stop. It was a bad goal, but then he responds by playing lights out for the rest of the game. Islanders shut that game down in the third period. You love to see it. It was awesome. And on the second leg of a back-to-back, Isles have been really strong on back-to-backs this year, especially the second leg. They did that again Tuesday in Arizona. Monday night, they played a really high-scoring team, which is really a high-scoring team because of one line. The Avalanche do not throw waves and waves and waves of scoring at you. They have they are a one-line team. They come out, and that line tries to blitz you, and the Islanders held the fort. Really held the fort. Hard work by Brock again on the Eberle goal, and Eberle needed that one bad. He had a long drought. Eberle needed that Monday night in Colorado. How about Johnny Boychuk? He played a great game, I thought, on both ends of the ice. He got his first goal of the year. Booming shot there on the power play. Power play's been slowly getting a little bit better. Slowly over these last three games. Took them long enough on Saturday against Detroit, right? What was it, their sixth one before they finally got it right? But still, it's better than the, you know, 1-for-27 that they were throwing up before that. The other unfortunate thing in the Colorado game was Hickey getting hurt. Could be a while, I don't know, but then he did skate today in Las Vegas. So maybe Hickey not as bad as originally thought. He did go on IR. Devon Toews, like we said, is going to be with the team. He skated with them today. He'll skate in warm-ups. He's not going to play, I don't think. I think they're going to put Spezza in there. They'd like to get the kid a couple more practices with the team, I would guess, before they put him out in the lineup. Hopefully it will be Sunday in Dallas. I'd like to see the kid get in there and play. And as Andrew Gross tweeted, he wouldn't be shocked if he's here for good, and I hope that he's right because I'd like to see that. There's a few guys, even when Hickey comes back, that I could play Toews over him, specifically Pelech. So hopefully he's here to stay. And it's the opposite of what I said last week. I really thought that if they were winning and they were doing the things that they're doing, staying in a playoff spot, that they wouldn't jump to the kids. I applaud them for making the move. Injecting the kids now, was some of it because of injury? Sure. I don't think Toews gets the call yesterday if Hickey doesn't get hurt, but he's going to get a chance to grab that and not go back. I like to see it. They're going to give Hosang a chance to stick around. Applaud the Islander management and the coach for maybe getting the young kids involved, despite the fact that they're winning. But those guys have to commit to what this team has been doing defensively. If they do that, they will stick around. I had a nice long chat with Nick Hershon, who, of course, authored the book We Want Fish Sticks. It's long. It's about an hour, and it's great. I really enjoyed it. Nick came and met me in the studio where I do the show. We had a long chat about the book, all things Islanders, a really good time. So I'm going to take a break early here because I want to get to that. And then after that, hopefully a little breakdown of what happened in the Vegas game. So the Isle Seat Podcast will roll on right after this. The Isle Seat Podcast is brought to you by 3J's Auto and Customs. Brooklyn's finest full-service custom shop is located in the Cobble Hill section and handles all things automotive, from custom lighting to performance modifications, as well as general and collision repairs, including insurance claims. 3J's Auto and Customs handles it all. For more information, visit www.3jsauto.com or on Facebook at facebook.com/3jsauto. Santorini Restaurant. Santorini is family-owned and operated for over 20 years and offers a variety of the best gyros, salads, and signature Greek dishes sure to please. located at 133 Merrick Avenue in Merrick, New York. Santorini Restaurant, it's all about family. Oakwood Automation, if you are looking to leverage modern technology to control your home or business, Oakwood Automation Systems has you covered. Put control over your alarm system, surveillance cameras, home theater, indoor and outdoor audio, and so much more in the palm of your hand. For more information, go to oakwoodautomation.com or find us on House and Facebook by searching Oakwood Automation. Bright Building Services. Bright Building Services is a full-service commercial cleaning company serving businesses throughout the New York metro area for over 22 years. With clients spanning all sectors from boutique fitness and corporate headquarters to laboratories and medical facilities. Contact them for all of your commercial cleaning needs. For more information, please visit brightbuildingservicesny.com or check them out on Instagram or Facebook at Bright Building Services. That's Bright, spelled B-R-I-T-E.
This Christmas, baby, please come home.
Yeah!
The snow's coming down. And we're back. Mike Carver here with you, the Isle Seat Podcast, as we close in on the Christmas and New Year's holidays coming up next week. Not sure yet if we're going to do a little add-on next week, if we're going to have a show during the Christmas to New Year's week. I'm not 100% sure yet. It's going to determine if I can get into the studio one night. Also, the Islanders don't play a lot after Dallas. They don't really play again until Friday, I believe, so won't be as much to talk about. So could be a week off next week for the Isle Seat Podcast. I'm not 100% sure yet. We'll see where things go. Special guest this week, and I've been waiting a few weeks to get him in studio with me, and this is going to be a lot of fun. Nick Hershon, who's the author of the new book, We Want Fish Sticks, the bizarre and infamous rebranding of the New York Islanders, a dark period in the franchise's history that we all know. Nick, thanks for coming down. How are you, my friend?
Very good. Thanks, Mike. I really appreciate you having me.
I know you've probably been asked this a lot. Why cover the kind of subject that for the majority, or pretty much all, let's be honest, Islander fans, is like the black hole, the black stain on like their heart of, you know, especially the older dynasty crowd. I mean, they despise the jersey. Why this topic and this subject? What was it about it that drew you to it?
I was just so curious because when I started going to the games in the late 1990s, I saw some people wearing fisherman jerseys in the crowd, and I knew the team wasn't wearing them on the ice. I didn't really hear much about the history of them. Why did they change jerseys? Why did they end up going back to the original logo? And I just wanted to know that story. You know, I'd see clips here and there of Ziggy Palfrey or Travis Green scoring a goal. Didn't really know all of the context of what happened. And I was also growing up in the era when Mike Milbury was the general manager. And I didn't understand all of the fan hate for him so early on in my fandom. I was like, I just got here. I didn't really know what he had done in the start in 1995 when he first became
well,
a coach.
Well, he did plenty.
Yeah, exactly.
As you found out.
I found that out very quickly doing the research for this book.
And you, of course, you were a sports writer for a little while. Now you're a teacher. Just give everybody a little breakdown what you do now, what you have done. You've done books on, I know you did a book on the history of the Coliseum as well.
Right.
So just give everybody a little breakdown.
Yeah, so I was a reporter for the New York Daily News from 2005 to 2011, and I covered community news mostly in Queens, which is where I'm from. And then I started teaching on the side a little bit, doing adjuncting at St. John's University. Then I ended up going to Ohio University to get my PhD in mass communication.
The Bobcats.
Yes, exactly.
Big win over the Aztecs.
Oh, you Bobcats. Wow, you didn't confuse it with OSU. I get that all the time.
No.
So I went over there, and that's where I did my dissertation on the Fisherman logo. So I was like 450 miles away from Long Island doing this stuff.
And I mean, a topic to do your dissertation on, the Fisherman logo.
You are the only dissertation ever that has fish sticks in the title.
Oh,
you
man,
know?
That's bizarre.
And then, so I graduated there in 2016, and I got a job as a journalism professor at William Patterson University in Wayne, New Jersey,
nice.
Which is about 20 miles away from New York City.
Cool, that's awesome. Congratulations,
thank
that's
you.
Great stuff. And now you have dove into writing this book, which you had a head start on by doing the dissertation.
Right, yeah. I mean, pretty much the dissertation was the book. There were some little add-ons, and obviously I have a lot more photos in there and some different stories. But for the most part, I wrote this dissertation as a book.
Right. And here's the thing with me where I start with this. And this logo and this jersey,
to me, it's like, it's obviously the thing that everybody looks at when they look at that time period. But especially reading your book, and it kind of brought back a lot of memories for me. I was 14, 15 years old when this stuff was going on. So I remember a lot of it, but there's parts that I didn't remember that came back to me reading the book. For me, that fisherman jersey is like, you draw the line in the sand amongst all the Islander fans. Take them all. Pull them all. There is no middle ground, I feel like. There is either absolute hate, and I mean hate, for that jersey and what it represents and everything, or there is the other side, which loves it, thinks that it should have been a third jersey now, today, this year.
Right.
And there's like, there's no middle ground on it. It's amazing the type of conversation that that logo and that jersey bring.
Right. I love the emotion and the passion. I mean, that's what, it's always drawn me to writing about Nassau Coliseum first, because you mentioned I did a book on Nassau Coliseum in 2010 and now doing the book on the fisherman logo, because those games that I spent growing up at Nassau Coliseum, just seeing the passion of the fan base. And as you say, this is a weird topic where it splits people up, and some people would think, you know, is this a Rangers fan doing this research because he wants to remind Islanders fans of this terrible time?
Yep.
And it's like, no, I just thought this is an interesting story. And I was kind of surprised that with all of the sports writers covering the team at the time and everybody else who's out there, that this book hadn't been written
about five times the amount to cover it now, by the way.
Right.
I mean, it was, the team was a lot more heavily covered in the mid-90s than it is now.
Right. Every major newspaper had a beat writer there on the team and, and all the sports networks. And I slept. But yeah, so I just thought it was kind of amazing. And there haven't been many books written about the Islanders in general. I didn't grow up with the Dynasty era team, so I didn't feel I would be fit to write that kind of a book. And this was a great story, though, where almost all the major players are still alive. They're willing to talk about this. Enough time has passed that some of them are not in hockey anymore. They don't need to worry about what they say because
right.
They could anger somebody.
Like Mick Vokoda.
Exactly. Or Rich Pilon or Tommy Soderstrom.
They're not worried about what they say to you removed from it.
And that was
terrific.
They're
not going out to dinner with Milbury tomorrow.
Exactly.
They could say whatever they wanted about him.
And half the owners of that time are in jail.
Right.
So you don't have to worry about like John Spano coming out to get you.
Right.
Or some
the pigs
of the
at the trough. Or any of the other guys, right? And what brings me back to it is, and this is where I'll start with the book, because how does, to me, the logo and the jersey is the thing that people remember. But to be fair, to me personally, that whole time period was bad for so much more. There was so many other things that were happening in that 2 to 3 year span that were light years worse than what they were wearing on the front of their jersey. It's amazing.
Right. That's the major thesis of my book, right, is that it's not that the logo itself was some terribly different logo from what any other teams were proposing. Yeah, it looks similar to the Gorton's Fisherman. That was a faux pas, but that alone probably wouldn't have downed it. Yeah. But when exactly what you said is what I discovered is it's not just the jersey. It's the hiring
everything.
Of Mike Milbury, who becomes a disgrace. It's
pushing Brett Lindros as like this going to be this huge star when before the guy even played a game in the NHL.
The better Lindros.
They were running around. Not only were they putting the ads up, but like Maloney's sitting there telling you he's going to be better than Eric. Like, it's stuff like that had nothing to do with. They could have been wearing the jersey they wore during the early 80s and those Stanley Cup years, but to run around saying that Brett Lindros is going to be this enormous star, like, that was a part of it that I personally forgot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was a 14, 15-year-old kid. I knew Brett Lindros. I obviously was a major hockey fan. I knew that he was a high draft pick of the Islanders, and I knew that he never played. That's pretty much what I remembered about
right.
Brett Lindros, and that he had concussion problems, et cetera, et cetera. Reading this book, you really get to remember that. They pushed him like he was the next Wayne Gretzky or Eric Lindros. They pushed
right.
him like he was going to be his brother.
Yeah. Well, there were actually only a few people who they kind of pushed as the face of the rebrand, and it's terrible to remember because it was Brett Lindros, as you say, didn't ever have the potential really of his brother and obviously didn't pan out, unfortunately, to head injuries. But then it was Mike Milbury when he became coach. He used to be an ESPN analyst, and he was coach of the Bruins. And so they thought, here's some guy who fans will remember. And then the last one was John Spano, because he becomes the owner, and everyone thinks he's going to buy elite players and rebuild Nassau Coliseum, and he ends up being a con artist. So these are the three standard bearers of your brand. And at the same time, they don't promote guys like Ziggy Palfy, who is
only
very
scored 40
dynamic
goals back to back.
Right.
And you put in the book There was other teams that wanted to interview Ziggy Palfy, and he was doing things like he had come over here. He's obviously learning the language. He's learning living in America, and he had like an outgoing personality, like a really like, you know, kind of zany guy, and he was fun and the long hair, the whole deal, and it was like he didn't matter, and he was the best player on the team.
I just don't get it. I mean, looking back at those clips of seeing Ziggy Palfy play in that era, because I wasn't around to see it live.
No, he was awesome.
It's just unbelievable to see the kind of player that he was. And I get some of the problems that they had with him. They thought that maybe he wasn't going to be a true team leader. Okay, so maybe he's not your captain. But still, he's a very exciting player. And Market, he's a young guy. He could grow up with the team. They could have had a very good line, you know, him and Travis Green, all these other guys who they had who really could have grown up together. But unfortunately, they traded everybody. Right. That's another reason why Mike Milbury is not beloved by this fan base.
How did it, and, you know, it's weird because in 1993, in that spring, they make a great run to the Eastern Conference Finals. They knock off the two-time defending champs, the Penguins. Pierre Turgeon has a huge year. Things are looking really strong for them. Like, in one calendar year, what the hell happened? Like, it's so bizarre because a year later they get swept by the Rangers. And it seemed like they had to take that Ranger loss, and that was like their basis for completely ripping apart the entire franchise and starting over. Like, right. Just because they got swept by the Rangers, they had to go and rip the whole thing down.
It doesn't make a lot of sense. They were a franchise in flux, though, because they had John Pickett was their owner, and he was the owner from the dynasty years, but he was still technically the owner, but now he was absentee.
But the other guys were controlling.
Yeah, and so he ceded the control to the Gang of Four minority stakeholders. So you have these guys who don't really know as much about the team's history, don't have that appreciation for the Stanley Cup era logo and all of that, and they overreact to the fact they got swept by the Rangers, which... yes. Is it embarrassing? Sure. But do we change our franchise look just because of one playoff series loss? No. And that's just kind of starting that they were able to do that. And they changed so many things at once. You know, Al Arbor is leaving the organization around this time, and Lorne Henning.
They wanted to wash away, it seemed like the entire past. Like they gave you the feel that not only did we want to change the jersey, we basically don't even want to, you know, acknowledge what happened in the 80s, and they wanted to basically start as like a brand new expansion franchise almost, is how it made you feel, seeing the success of the jersey sales from San Jose and from Anaheim and the Panthers and seeing all that stuff. It was like the money grab was there for them, and they just did such a poor job about it that it really wasn't.
Right, and that if you're going to introduce a new logo and then the team starts immediately losing, then people are just going to associate it with all the bad times, no matter what you do. So it was, you have to give the fans something else. You know, when the Islanders are headed for an uptick, that's when you might rebrand. Actually, right now, when it looks like they're going to head into a new arena, when they have Barry Trotz and Lou Lamoriello, okay, there's some hope on the horizon. They may not win right away, but they're going to start going in the positive direction. There was no reason to believe that was going to happen in 1995.
No, not at all. And then you get to how they came up with this thing. And I got to tell you, I'm not a marketing wizard. You are not as well. You're a great writer. You're a great professor. I do radio. And I think even the two of us can probably sit here and kind of think, man, you know, I'm going to come up with a logo for a hockey team or any sports franchise. I'm going to go and take the basis off of a song. And that's how I'm going to, a Billy Joel song. I love Billy Joel. I love Billy Joel. And I love Down East Alexa. I think it's a great, great song. How these guys sat in that room and said, you know what? This is where we're going to go. We want to take this. Not even his biggest hit by a mile either, by the way.
It's not Piano Man. It's not just the way you are.
Not even his biggest hit by a mile. But that's, you know, here nor there. How somebody sat in a room, Nick, and decided this is where we want to base the rebranding of our logo is off of a Billy Joel song that wasn't even new that year. I get it. It was 1994 at that point. The song was 5 years old at that point, too.
Right.
Wasn't like it was his newest hit. Bang, we're going to strike off of this. Hey, the guy didn't even show up when they wanted to do things. How does somebody sit in a room, Nick, and decide we're going to take Down East Alexa and build a logo out of it?
I think that goes to the Long Island identity. And they were struggling with what is one symbol of Long Island that we can have on a mascot first and then eventually in our logo. And as you look at Long Island, it is a lot of, as I think I put in the book, impressive pieces that don't make a cohesive whole.
Right.
So it's just, there's all these, there's the Hamptons, there's Sagamore Hill where Teddy Roosevelt lived, there's, you know, the Crave Aviation area near Nassau
Jones
Coliseum
Beach.
And all there's that stuff.
Yeah.
But is there one thing where if you were to go right now to Texas or California or somewhere else in the world and say Long Island, besides maybe like a Long Island iced tea, what is going to be the thing that people immediately come up with? And so Billy Joel, okay, they think he is one kind of a weird way to connect it with a celebrity, but all right, he is Long Island's favorite son, but he's someone who doesn't really seem to take an interest in hockey. It's not like he's known for going to the Islanders games. So to hope that people will make this kind of tenuous connection between, oh, a fisherman on the logo, that's like the guy that Billy Joel was singing about in Downeaster Alexa
right.
5 years ago, it's not really going to connect for most fans.
Nick Hershon's with us. He wrote the great book, We Want Fish Sticks. We're chatting about it here on the Aisle Seat Podcast. And then you get to, you know, they kind of get this logo together. They go to this company that has done this in the past. They had built logos and rebrandings for other franchises, not just in hockey, but throughout North American sports. And did they have other ideas besides this? Or was this like, all right, we're doing this. We're not going to ask anybody about it, which we'll get to after that. Was there other options besides that?
There were clearly other options because I interviewed Ed O'Hara, who's the co-founder of the firm SME that did the designs for the Islanders. And as with any process, they start out by giving probably dozens or maybe 100 different designs. For whatever reason, the Islanders picked up immediately on this fisherman. And it's kind of unclear since time has clouded all of this and I didn't get a chance to see the other logos. They probably have all been discarded. So it sounds like they thought about other maritime images. One of the designers said something like the sea god Neptune and with his pitchfork.
Which would have played into the whole Mighty Duck, Shark, Panther thing that was going on at the time with teams putting out new logos.
Right. And then there was also an idea of apparently the NHL was convincing them you should do just a word mark, just the word Islanders and have the I and Islanders be a lighthouse like they eventually did on the shoulder patch.
Probably would have been better than what they did.
So there, well, pretty much anything else they would have picked right here would have been better. But for whatever reason, it seems like one of the Islanders co-owners at the time, Stephen Walsh, takes a liking to this logo and presents it at a meeting and says, hey, I like this logo. What do you guys think? And so all the other executives are kind of afraid to contradict their boss.
Right.
So you're not going to say, boss, I don't think so, even though you and maybe there's some
the
talk
room.
That his, yeah.
Right.
That Stephen Walsh's kid supposedly liked it. And that's what, so the room is just going to say like, okay, sure. And that's not a very good design process. There was no focus groups. There was no interviews, anything like that.
Now, I get that the other people in the room don't want to go against their boss. They don't want to say, hey, this is a horrible idea. Why don't we look at some other stuff? But I would assume that Stephen Walsh is a pretty successful guy, right? I mean, he was part owner of a hockey franchise.
Although he's now in prison. But yes.
Now in prison, but at the time, you would think, how does he not say to himself, maybe should we find out if people are going to like this? Should we maybe go and ask fans, ask ex-players, ask anybody, because they then waited till after they had played two-thirds of a season in the jersey before they finally started taking some feedback from the fans, which, of course, as we know, Nick, turned into really bad feedback.
Right. A lot of it was very anecdotal feedback, too. At one point, one of the Islanders executives goes to Quinnipiac University and goes to one of the high schools on Long Island and just kind of passes around the jersey to the students and says, hey, what do you guys think? And there's just kind of like a hand vote of, yeah, I think I like it. Yeah, I don't. And that's about all they did before they unveiled the jersey. And the rest of it was just once the jersey is unveiled, Newsday runs this poll and asks fans, what do you think? And do you want to toss it back as they
right.
put in their headline or keep it? And yeah, you would think that if they had asked some of the former players, I think also it would have been key to get those former players as ambassadors for this. Because if you have a Bobby Nystrom or
they needed to be behind
there, yeah.
They needed to have those guys sell it. Because
sure.
those are the guys that the Dynasty fan that hates it to this day and hated it then and always will hate it, they look to those guys as everything that represents the Islanders. Because let's be fair, we know this, you've been a fan since the late 90s, early 2000s, and that's all this franchise has ever had, okay? It really is.
That's
and
right.
I've kind of even said a few times recently in the past 5 to 10 years that I still think that that they do go back to it a lot, the dynasty years. Now, I get it. It's the crown jewel of your franchise's history. But at some point, you do want to make new memories and new experiences for your fan base, and they never did it. And I still think that they roll these guys out there a lot, considering they never win. And it's like their way to say, all right, well, another season that we didn't get out, make the playoffs or get out of the first round, but we're having another night where, you know, Bossy, Trottier, Bill, they're all coming out. So it does get a little much. Now, that's now in 2018. I can imagine that in 1994, that feeling had not really presented itself yet.
Sure.
I think now, 20 years even after that, is when somebody like me or others can start to say, all right, let's get some new, let's make some new memories here. But in 94, it still had to be fresh of these guys winning. And it wasn't the time probably yet to go away from that.
Yeah, it was only a decade old, so that was still fresh in people's mind. Although the argument you made before about moving away from the dynasty era and trying to just create some other sort of memories for this franchise, exactly what you verbalize is one of the arguments for having the Fisherman logo.
Yeah.
Let's create something new because the original dynasty logo is kind of hampering the current team and some of the young players. You have guys being drafted like, you know, Todd Bertuzzi.
Being compared to dynasty players immediately. He's going to be Clark Gillies.
Exactly, and that's so unfair.
Eric Fischow's going to be Billy Smith. You know, I get that part of it. There's also a part in the book where, you know, a lot of the players basically say, you know, we don't really care what we're wearing. We just, you know, we're going out to play is pretty much where. But they didn't even ask those guys either. They didn't ask anybody but what they thought of this logo before they decided that this was going to be it. It's so amazing, Nick, that they could do this.
I mean, I think it's also just what was going on in sports at the time and that it's kind of incredible to think about it today because of the tremendous research process that goes into these designs and everything. Yeah, they test out things on social media. They leak things. Is this getting a good reaction? Back then, I think not just the Islanders, but a lot of teams were just kind of, they didn't have social media. They were just kind of putting some things out there.
Such a different time.
Yeah. And
we take it for granted. It's such a different time than it is now.
Yeah. So that kind of surprised me too. And that was part of the context I wanted to show in the book is that, yes, were the Islanders an anomaly in the sense of some of the crazy things were happening? Sure. But they still were working with the NHL to pick out this design firm. This was still a leading sports design firm. So it wasn't like all of this was just being done in an amateurish way.
Let's get to some other parts of the rebranding, if we should say so. And look, I always thought that Mike Milbury was an absolute clown. Your book confirmed it. Your book made it even more so that he's an absolute clown. It's strange because he did come there with this sense of integrity, this sense of this guy has done something and we need that. But man, Nick, it just... it like got off to such a bad start. And the amazing thing is that the guy was there forever. Like it's the hard part about it is reading the book. And that's just the first 2 or 3 years that he was a member of the franchise or part of the franchise. He was around for like another 10 years after that.
Exactly.
Can you believe that?
Yeah, it is stunning that he lasted so long into my time as a fan after what he did. And it was really startling for me, again, growing up in the Mike Must Go era when all the fans were already way against him. And to see headlines in Newsday in 1995 before they hire him, Isles need Milbury.
Right.
So many of the reporters saying, if you don't get Milbury, you're a joke. He's the best coach out there on the market. If you want to prove that you're in the big leagues, you can afford the best paid coach in hockey, you need to get someone like Mike Milbury. He's a strict coach. He's going to, you know, get these guys together. And for young rookie players, he's going to show them that Boston Bruins identity of being tough and all that. But that really wasn't going to work with the kind of mix of players that they had. When he was with the Bruins, they had Cam Neely. They were already a very good team, and they were just on, you know, they just needed a little push. And maybe his kind of method was okay. It would work in that system. But for the Islanders, the way he developed or a lack of development of talent, I think actually that's one of the things that undid Todd Bertuzzi. And when I, you know, again, for me, I only knew Todd Bertuzzi from his later years and the Steve Moore incident, and the longest suspension in NHL history and all that.
Yep.
But then in seeing some of the stuff that started in this era where Bertuzzi was more of like a scorer and then ended up having all of these incidents.
He was molded by Mad Mike.
Yeah.
And basically Mike molded him into that.
And it was right there in some of the Newsday articles of, you know, Milbury challenging, you know, Bertuzzi in the press.
Now, we still have some, you want to say, colorful coaches today. I mean, Tortorella will still tell it like it is. But for the most part, the professional coach, not just in hockey, but in any of the leagues in 2018, is very tight-lipped, does not say much, rarely tells you what they really think about, especially about their own players. You never hear it. This guy showed up that training camp. Like, he's on the job 2 months. It's his first camp with these guys. And he is just slaying daggers at anybody and anybody that the press asked him about. He had no problem just shelling it out there.
Yeah, I have this part in the book where I just have excerpts of all these quotes that, as you say, it's kind of surreal to think
that
an NHL coach.
Happening today.
I can't.
Like, it would be like, you know.
It would make.
I mean, the press would love it. Press would love it.
Right.
It would be.
So, yeah, well, and as a former
They'd start
reporter,
covering the Islanders more.
As a former reporter, I'm reading this stuff thinking that this would be incredible to have a coach like this. I mean, it must have been really fun to cover the team at the time. And it was really fun for me thinking as I'm going through this story, what's going to happen next? I wonder what he's going to say, you know, in the next issue of Newsday that I'm go through on microfilm to put into the book. But yes, the way that he treated the players, which was, again, very unsuccessful, because just telling like young rookie players if he heard that their parents were going to be in town that night to see them play, and he would say, oh, so you guys aren't going to dress that night.
Awful.
What's the point of it? What is this achieving?
And that's the part of it that you just didn't get. Like, why? What are you trying to prove? How does that, doing something like that, the example that you just brought up of when he found out the player's parents were going to be there, how does that further that player as a National Hockey League player? Like, what does it do to make him play better? I just didn't understand a lot of the things, and he didn't adapt because he played in a time where, look, there were skillful guys, there's no doubt, but there was more of the rough and tough bruising era of hockey when he played. When the mid-90s rolled around, I get that the trap was starting to evolve and teams were going to that, but more European players came in, there was more skill players that didn't do that stuff, Ziggy Palfy being one of those guys, of course, which is why Mike probably didn't like him. Yeah, he didn't adapt at all. He was just like, you're going to do this, and that's it. That's the way it's going
to
go.
Everybody has to fit this kind of same mold. And he also clearly wanted to be the center of attention and be the media darling, and that's why he's making these kinds of comments. Remember, he had just come from being an ESPN analyst when he was hired for this job. So he likes being on camera.
I mean, even today, being on NBC, he still will say some things that you scratch your head and you go... I mean, it's just, it was probably in, what, the last 3 or 4 years where he admitted on air to the Ulf Samuelson spitting thing, you know, which comes up in the book. He obviously then didn't admit to it, but he, as in the last however many years, admitted to that when he was on NBC doing the game. So he's always been outspoken, and it's good for TV, but I don't know if it's so good to be the head coach. Now, I'm going to guess, you talked to a lot of people for this book. I think it was over 40 or 50.
53.
People, between players, executives,
coaches, broadcasters, designers.
I'm gonna guess Mad Mike declined. I'm just gonna go out on a limb and say Mike didn't want to have any talk with you about the 94 to 97 New York Islanders. Am I about right on that?
That is exactly right.
Was he the one guy where you were like, man, you know, I wish I had him? Was he like obviously the biggest was there anybody else who was like, I'm not talking to you? What about, did Maloney talk to you?
No.
Maloney or
Don Maloney, who was
another goon. Another
Kirk
goon.
Muller, who was
what a shock. another one of my favorite guys, Kirk Muller. I'm going to go back to Kirk Muller right now, but tell me who else just was like, Nick, I'm sorry. Mr. Hershon, I'm sorry, but I am not talking to you and making myself look even worse than I already look. Who else was it?
Those are the three I really wanted the most, honestly. And I really wanted to tell this story because, again, to be fair to all these folks, I come from a journalist perspective. You want to give people a chance to respond if you're going to criticize them. And so you want to say, like, I know this doesn't look good for you. Can you maybe give some side of the story? Where then it changes my impression a little bit. And I'm like, well, that makes some sense about what he was doing in the era. Or maybe one of these guys wants to apologize to the fan base or whatever.
Right.
And I didn't ever get to those people in particular. I was more like getting to NBC, who said Mike Milbury declines.
Right.
Or, you know,
now, Muller obviously has coached around the league.
Right.
He was in Carolina for a few years. So he was probably easy to go to PR for whoever he was with. And I don't want to talk to you about that, those times. Kirk Muller's interesting. I despise the man. I always will. As a 14, 15, you know, year old kid, I hated the trade because, you know, when you're that age and you get attached to somebody like, you know, Pierre Turgeon, let's just say. Now, for me, it was Pat LaFontaine. Pat LaFontaine, for me, was, up to this day, my favorite Islander of all time. Because I missed the dynasty years. I mean, I was alive, but I missed them. You know, I wasn't old enough to be watching hockey.
Right.
So then, my dad took me to my first game in, like, 88, 89. Pat LaFontaine was the guy on the team. I was crushed when the Pat LaFontaine trade happened. So I could just imagine it didn't hurt me like it did the LaFontaine trade, but the Pierre Turgeon, Kirk Muller trade also was like, I mean, oh, man. But you got it, were like, Kirk Muller, he's a really good player. Like, I play him on NHL 93, you know, with the Canadians, and he was on the Devils, and he did all this great stuff. And then you come to find out that he is an absolute, no doubt about it, jerk. And I don't care if Montreal told him that he wasn't going to get traded. I don't care if he wanted more money. I don't care what he wanted. You're a professional hockey player. Show up and do the job. The guy never did that, and I'll hate him forever, Nick. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's kind of sad about it. Going into the context from the time, right, Pierre Turgeon actually was not doing so well for the Islanders at that point. It was after the Dale Hunter hit.
He was never the same after.
He's not going to be the same player. Vladimir Malakhov, who they also traded away to Montreal in that deal.
Another stiff who didn't want to be here anymore.
Exactly. And even the players of the time were saying that, right, you know, anonymously in the media. So getting rid of those two guys in and of itself, it was a little bit tough for Turgeon because of what he had meant to the franchise, you know, 93 and all that. But I think it made sense. And to bring in Muller and Matthew Schneider, the defenseman,
who's a very good player.
Yes.
Very good player.
And who did speak to me for the book and became an all-star with the Islanders. I think he was the only all-star to actually play with the Islanders in the Fisherman jersey era because Ziggy Palfy was hurt the one time that he was selected. And, you know, so to have those two come in, and they come from the Canadians who just won the Cup a few years prior. Maybe they're going to bring some of that veteran leadership and the scoring punch that they need. But when Muller doesn't work out and refuses to report to Long Island, it's so frustrating where he...
It was over from the jump.
And then he says in his first few interviews, the key about me is I come to play every single night. Huh. And as I write in the book, but for the first few games, you weren't even in the country. No. You were staying in Montreal, and there were all these excuses we're hearing about, oh, he's just emotional because he was the Canadiens captain, no, or the exchange rate between his contract and Canadian dollars and American dollars. But it is really sad because if that trade, again, there's all these like little things that I found during this period. If like one or two of these goes right, then maybe we wouldn't be talking right now. Maybe this wouldn't have been as embarrassing as it ended up being.
And what floored me, because I obviously did not remember this from back in the day, was a couple of the players that you talked to. I think it might have been Pilon or Vekoda. One of them, I forget which one.
They were both great interviews.
We're both basically kind of like, I'm going to say, like, gave Muller a pass. Like, they kind of did. Like, there was a part where they were like, you know, I don't really blame him. Maybe he was a good guy in the room to the other players. We weren't in the room. We have no idea. All we know of him is that he didn't want to play for the Islanders, and we despise him. So it's possible that when those guys talk to you, maybe they have, you know, memories of him being a good guy with them. Maybe he picked up the tab a lot at dinner. Who knows? But they kind of let Muller off with a bit of a pass. Do you agree?
Well, I think that there's a fraternity of players, and right, they're unlikely to criticize each other unless it was really extreme. Even when I was asking a lot of these players about Mike Milbury, who was widely criticized in the media at the time and since then, most players were unwilling to really reveal anything too negative and still be diplomatic. So I get that. And I can relate, and I try to mention that in the book. Yes, I can get in our jobs. We can't get traded.
Right.
And all of a sudden it's like, okay, Mike, you've been sent to radio station out in L.A.
Yeah,
and you're going to have to uproot your family and move out tomorrow night. And you got to be there tomorrow morning for work. I get that can be really rough, especially when you've been one place. You with the captain there, they win the cup. And yet, as you say, that's kind of the mark of a professional. And right. Stan Fischer described in the book when he was waiting for the media is all waiting for Matthew Schneider and Kirk Muller to come down to
typical
reporters.
Typical Stan, you know. Where is this guy?
Yeah. You know? And he kind of says in the book, it's like, you know, what kind of pro is this guy? Where's Kirk Muller? We don't see him. We just got Matty Schneider. I mean, he's nice. He's a nice Jewish boy, but where's Kirk Muller? So I think that that's kind of what the bigger picture was for outside impressions, right, and why the brand failed, the rebranding of the Islanders, is for most people, they're not going to consider, like, Kirk Muller's personal situation, whatever. It's just
right.
He was supposed to be here. We have a big game tonight. I think there's a game versus the Rangers that he misses.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, we want to unveil our big acquisition.
Big acquisition, and he doesn't show up.
Yeah.
And that's where it comes back to what we said at the beginning. You know, it was so much more than a logo. It was it was Maloney. It was Milbury. It was Muller. It was Spano. You know, we haven't gotten to Spano yet. We'll get to him. There were things that made that period of Islander hockey so much worse than the dopey logo. And that is why the book is excellent. That's why the book is outstanding, because you take those parts and you really show that this is why we hate this time period. We don't hate this time period because of this stupid dopey logo.
Just the logo.
It's right. Not the logo. They're running around wearing the logo now, Nick. Look right. at them. They're selling the jersey again. I went there. I know you were there too. When they went back December 1st, first night back at the yep. at the old barn, you know, the NYCB Live. I went downstairs because I wanted to check. It was my first time being in there since they quote unquote, you know, refurbished it. So I went there. I wanted to check the whole place out. I go downstairs to the, you know, down the escalator, you know, the old ice level area.
Sure.
I look over to my left. They got like a little concession stand set up. And there it is, you know, 100 of them. Fisherman jerseys lined up. December 1st, 2018, Nick. Mm-hmm. They had racks of them sitting there in the basement of the Nassau Coliseum. And people are buying them. They're flying off the shelves. It's crazy to think about it now.
Yeah. I mean, 20 years later, for the first time in 20 years, right? Uh-huh. It's at the shelves again at Nassau Coliseum, and it had been whitewashed from their history. But again, that shows you a few things. First of all, that the design itself was not so atrocious. And also that fans associated it maybe with just a retro nostalgic look. Or if they grew up in that period, like you were talking about, you know, being a teenager that time, well, maybe we have some good memories of just going to games with our buddies and with our parents and the first few times we went to a game. And so you don't always, like, I have great memories of 1999-2000. You know, I'd love to meet Mats Lindgren and Tim Connolly
right.
and Mary Strakowski. It's not because they're NHL Hall of Famers. It's because when I was first going to games, they're what stoked my love for the team.
Right.
And so I will always, you know, hold that as part of me. You know, meeting Felix Poffin would be amazing. You know, so I think that that's what that logo means to a portion of the fan base.
Right. There's a couple things I wanna get to. I'm trying to remember everything in the book that I thought was extremely interesting. The mascot, funny. It really was, because that's part of the 14, 15-year-old in me that was like, Niles, dude, that guy was unbelievable. The big head, like, he was so goofy looking and so dumb. And I know I wasn't one of those kids that kept kicking him in the groin. Like, I know it wasn't me.
You sure?
But I'm pretty sure it wasn't me. But, man, like, what were they thinking about? I'm holding a copy of Nick's book now, just looking at it again. Like, what were they doing here? This is how bad this got. Like, this is how bad this logo was. They replaced him with a dragon, Nick. They
That's
replaced
right.
this with a dragon. How'd they do this, Nick?
Yeah, well, the mascot was the first element of the rebrand. They wanted to kind of test the
temperature. He was actually there the year, the strike-shortened year,
yes.
right?
Yes, 1995.
That year, with the old logo on him.
With the original Islanders right. logo on him. And he took different forms, because in that first year, he was this kind of bulbous, you know, rotund.
They took a little weight off the costume yeah. the next year, right?
The first year. And it was, like, so difficult for the mascot to walk around and greet
right.
fans and everything because of his outfit, which just didn't make any sense. In the second year, at least they slimmed him down.
Right.
But it was always kind of hard. It's just the same idea of, like, what is Long Island? What can we have in a mascot? Well, it's just a guy wearing an Islanders jersey.
Yeah.
So there's really nothing else that we could pick. And I think they did have other options. You know, with the maritime culture, you could have had a seagull. You could have had a lighthouse. Right. You could have had, you know, a lot of other
things. You
brought
up duck in the book, but
right.
with the Mighty Ducks, that was,
that
they didn't feel like that would have been an issue.
Yeah.
There was other places. I mean, it's amazing. And the guy that wore the suit, he had some interesting stories too, because he was a guy that had some issues in his early 20s, before he got the job. He was a mascot in college, right? He was the St. John's
University
mascot.
Yep.
Then he gets the job as the Islander, and it was just, they hated him. Yeah. Like, not him, you know, but he was walking around in a symbol that most people despise.
Yeah, just Rob DeFiore is who you're talking about, and I'm so glad I was able to get a hold of him, because I
right.
just found him.
That had to be, was that the most, one of the more difficult ones to get a hold of?
Well, it was difficult in the sense of a lot of the hockey players, at least I kind of knew where they were.
Right.
There's Wikipedia pages that says this guy's a scout now, he's a coach now. With some of these other guys, it was scouring LinkedIn and Facebook
right.
and trying to figure out. That. And with a name like Rob DeFiore at Long Island, it's like, okay, it could be
a million
guys. So I just found him mentioned in one old newspaper article. I think it was from the New York Times from 1995. And I was able to track him down, and he was very open and honest about everything that happened.
I'm sure he was.
Talking about how, I mean, he talks about in the book, it's been publicized. at one time before he was the Islanders mascot, he was addicted to cocaine.
Right.
He suffered from depression.
The Islanders didn't know anything about that either.
And the Islanders didn't know
nothing about it.
Just another thing that just completely mentally checked out over there in 1994.
And yeah, and but
not
it
that the kid shouldn't have got the job. He had cleaned up at that point. But you would think they would have known these things. He is going to go hang out with the children in the seats,
right?
I mean, I'm glad he got the job, but geez. A little more work would have been good.
Yeah, and then it seems like when he did get the job, he actually was very successful as Johnny the Beast, the St. John's University mascot, and he made the fans laugh. And
he was into it.
Even some of the stuff that he talked about trying to do in the book, and I've seen like some of the old footage of what he was doing in the stands, and it seemed like a lot of people did find him comical.
Right.
But when he's wearing this logo, he just became the living embodiment of everything that the fans despise. Yep. So it's what you then discussed about people beating him up in the stands and calling him down to their seats and knocking him over the chairs. And for a guy who's already kind of emotionally fragile and what he had been going through a few years prior with addiction and depression, to then have him in a situation where the fans are beating him up, literally beating him up, it just wasn't going to ever work out.
No, it wasn't. I thought that was a really cool part of it. Eric Fichaud did a lot for you for this book. He wrote the foreword. He was a guy, I remember Eric Fichaud clear as day, because he was the future of the New York Islanders. I had a poster when I was 15 years old that they sold at the Coliseum, or that you could buy in the store, whatever it was. It was Berard, Fichaud, I forget who the other two were. Mm-hmm. Travis Green might have been on it.
Okay.
Coffey was probably. There was four players in a box, and it had the Fisherman logo on it, and Fichaud was up there, and it was like, this guy is the next real deal. Of course, it did not work out. We know what happened with Eric Fichaud, which is it just never happened. Something I had no idea of before I read the book. And I know I'm giving a lot. Listen, you're going to read the book anyway. You're going to read the book. I did not know that they were trying to acquire Jeremy Roenick and that Fichaud would have been in the deal with, refresh my memory, who the other two players with Fichaud? Well, or am I thinking it was either Tkachuk or Roenick? Which one was Fichaud in?
I think
the Roenick one.
I forget which trade he was going to be involved in.
I think it was the Jeremy Roenick. And it was him, was it Lachance?
Lachance.
Or,
yeah, they were. I know that they were thinking about doing it, but they would have lost so much of their young talent that they decided it wasn't worthwhile.
Gotcha.
And Mike Milbury was going to send an offer sheet to Roenick. And, and it never he never really sent it. Although I think, again, that was Milbury trying to kind of play around with the fan base and pretend like, look, we have a lot of money. We were in on the Jeremy Roenick sweepstakes.
Right.
We could have got Keith Tkachuk, but you didn't.
Yes.
And so at the end of the day, it doesn't matter that you say, I was willing to spend a lot of money on that.
Right. But you never did.
You never went through
it. You never did. And I just look at that now and I go, man, I would have did that trade in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Now, at the time, would we have traded Fichaud? I don't know.
Right.
At that point, we didn't know.
Some of it is
hindsight. But you look back on it now, and you go, man, they could have got Jeremy Roenick for Fichaud and a chance. Come on. Fichaud was very good, though, T, in the book.
No, he was amazing. I mean, I hooked up with him first just to do an interview with him. And it was exciting for me when he said yes, because he's a hockey analyst now on TV in Canada. Mm. So I know he has somewhat of a big profile up there. And he was just, he couldn't have been a nicer guy. He was just telling me all these great stories, a pure gentleman. And so then when it came around to figure out who's going to do the forward of the book, and I was kind of going through the list of different guys who were on the team, who is someone who is a kind of well-known part of that team, but also is an affable guy, someone who has somewhat of a social media presence, a high profile because he's on TV, he made the perfect sense. And I was able to talk to him more, as we were working on that forward together. And he gives you a different kind of perspective of being a young guy. We forget sometimes these are 18, 19, 20-year-old guys.
He's a kid.
Yeah. And they're just – and now all of a sudden they're playing against Wayne Gretzky and Mario Lemieux in the world's greatest hockey league. And they're still growing up. So they're just like, as he describes, going, nobody beats the Wiz.
Yeah.
And, just watching the movies and listening to rap music of whatever of that era. So it's kind of nice to just hear that perspective of what it was still like to be roommates with these guys and then how sad it was for them to start seeing so many of the players get traded away. Because I still think there's an element of Montreal Expos in here of if these guys had stayed together for another year or two and if they had better coaching.
Yeah.
That's what we're hearing
Milbury
so much now.
Milbury put them back so far with what he did. And Rick Bowness then gets behind the bench. It just never – everything was a quick – reaction. There was never any time to gel. It was now. The pressure was on him being the second fiddle in town, as we know at that point, really, you could say the third, because the Devils, Depending on who you talk to, some consider the Devils part of the metro. You know, the market. Some don't. Now I kind of figure the Devils more on their own, being in Newark now. But back then, when they were playing in East Rutherford, you kind of tied them in as all in the metropolitan area. And the Islanders were third, by a distant third at that point, because those two teams were good.
Yeah, and then the Rangers winning the Cup, and then the Devils winning the Cup, and then the Islanders unveiling Niles, the mascot.
Yeah.
So it's not really, they weren't on par. And it was such a precipitous drop-off, because the Islanders had been the dominant force, not just in the metro area, but in the world. They were the greatest hockey team, to then fall to this kind of bottom.
You finish it off with the Spano stuff. The Spano stuff, everybody has heard the Spano stuff a billion times. It's such a weird period, the whole thing. We know the whole thing's a weird period of Islander hockey, but Kevin Connolly did the Big Shot, I believe it was called. So there's been a lot done on Spano. Did you talk to Spano?
No, I didn't.
You didn't go down to the jail? You didn't go down and talk to him?
I actually did. There's a line in the book that some people picked up on where it's like, letters sent to the Islanders owners that were not returned from their correctional facilities. So I did, and I, to be clear, I made a legitimate effort to try to reach every single person who was involved.
No doubt.
And I had a long spreadsheet of when I made contact, who I called, who I spoke to, who said no if they denied it.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to make sure that I tried.
Because Spano, even to this day, judging by the Kevin Connolly film, is still like this, like kind of like, you know, boisterous type of guy. Obviously, he's been in jail now for a long time, but he came on the scene, and it was just like, wow. Like, I remember that clear as day. Like, this guy is going to change everything. Yeah. It's so weird what happened.
Well, and that's the last final sad chapter of this, is when Spano comes as a potential owner of the team in the second season of the Fisherman jerseys, you think, well, okay, there's all this Mueller business and Mike Milbury.
We've been getting kicked in the gut so much for the last 2 or 3 years that finally something good is going to happen.
Right.
And it was like, instead of kicking you in the gut, we're just going to drop a piano on you now. So that's what we're going to do now.
That's what's so amazing about it. And again, for me, as you read through the news footage, you know, that I was looking at the old newspaper stories, you see at the start, you know, again, all the positivity about, we finally have this Texas billionaire who's going to pump money in team. He's a true Islanders fan. He's going to rebuild Nassau Coliseum. He has the connections to make it happen. And all of this stuff seems like it's going to be really positive. And then to see how it starts falling apart and how the fans are still not aware of, he's bouncing checks as people are still holding Spano for president signs in Nassau Coliseum. And you just have to feel so sympathetic, I guess, for the Islanders, you know, just to understand what they went through, one thing after another after another. And I grew up with some of this, you know, being the only Islanders fan in my high school and having the Rangers fans mock me and all this stuff. And it's the same sort of thing. If you look at what happened, it was so sad to see that fall apart after people pinned all their hopes on this one guy is finally going to change it. And it didn't, you know, work out. So yeah, you just see another owner behind bars.
It was the ultimate blow to everything that happened during that period of this book. For that to be like the final, like I said, dropping the piano on your head pretty much, because you were looking for anything. You were grasping for anything to make you believe again. And it's just, it's crazy what happened with him. And he came in guns a-blazing, and it was all a joke. Like, it was just, what was there any, what did the, did you ask any of the players about the Spano? Tell me something. What did somebody, some of the guys say about the Spano era that really stuck out to you in terms of, did they think that, wow, this guy's going to come in and we're going to like have like a better shower now in the locker room? Like, did they think that, that this was happening too?
Oh yeah. Well, Spano also was known for being kind of gregarious and a show-off, and he would tell the players, you know, I'm going to sign this. I think it was Sergei Fedorov who was going to be a free agent that year. I'm going to go out and sign all these top guys. And, of course, they're believing it because they're seeing it's in the media, the NHL.
John, just give us hot water back here.
I mean, honestly. We just need a new shower head, please. But, yeah, no, they were obviously getting excited about it. And then there's a moment, which they describe in the Big Shot documentary, but Spano and his wife host all the Islanders players when they're, I think they're in Dallas to play the Stars, and they host them at their home and have a mariachi band come over, and all the players are kind of looking around, and trying to make the best of the situation, because even though he's presented as this billionaire guy, his house doesn't look as impressive as you would think someone of
that
regard
would have.
Right,
for somebody who's talking like they have billions and millions of dollars walking around, it wasn't quite at that level.
Yeah, and so some of the players are describing that. You know, I think it was Brian Smolinski in the book who says, you know, I'm looking around there and all the other guys are saying, man, this place rocks. It's the best. And he's like, no, this place sucks.
It's like, dude, we got better. We got better houses than this guy. What is going on here?
So that's kind of insane that they had to, you know, because
good old Smoke always
this.
Figures it out. Good old Smoke.
Yeah.
No,
and he was a great interview too about that. So a lot of them did get their hopes, just like with the fans, and it's sad for them too. I think that's another thing, you know, the players who had to deal with all of this stuff. That's why I dedicated the book to the players.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
they didn't ask for it.
No, and they're putting their bodies on the line. They're trying to win. I mean, I have a lot of respect for them. And Eric, you know, as writing the forward,
everybody except Mueller.
He's
the only guy I don't respect. But other than that, you're right. They didn't ask for this. Like, they're a lot of the young guys that were on that team in those years. It was their dream to play in the NHL. I mean, this was it for them, and they're there. And I forget who was it. Was it Belanger who showed up and? Like, he's like, what are they cheering up there? Like, what is going on? And the guy sits on the bench. He's like, they hate the jerseys, dude.
They're saying
like,
no more fish sticks.
No more fish sticks. Yeah. And then he ragged on the jersey, right? I guess he was trying to get behind the fans. He was like, yeah, the jersey stinks. That was a good. Who is your favorite out of all the guys from those teams that you talked to? Who did you have, you know, the most fun time with? Who gave you the best stuff? Who was the best time for you interviewing?
It's maybe a three-way tie. I mean, Mick Fukuda, who we talked about.
Fukuda's unbelievable.
And he gave me some great, you know, stories about him clashing with Milbury, and there were some really good things in there that I'd never seen published before. Tommy Soderstrom is a kind of wacky guy.
Really?
And he gave some really unfiltered feedback about what he felt about Mike Milbury.
Right.
So I really appreciated that. Rich Pilon, again.
Another Islander legend.
Yeah, and he gave some really great quotes, and a few times he got me because he's a very sarcastic guy, very funny guy. And so I asked all the different Islanders players at one point, like, where do you have your fisherman jersey today? I wanted to, like, did you keep your fisherman jersey? Because, you know, you think you just discard it. And he said, yeah, you know, I have it in my closet, in my bedroom. Every now and then my wife wants me to wear it to bed. And then he gives this long pause, and I'm on the other end of the phone like, oh, okay. And then he's like, ah, man, I'm just kidding.
With
you.
I'm just kidding.
And so, so it was, he got me on that one, and that was really cool.
Oh, that's awesome.
But yeah, I mean, so many of them, I was really grateful for anyone who would talk to me, first of all, because this was not a great part of their history.
But you got just about everybody.
Yeah.
Except for the goons. Yeah. I mean, you got pretty much all of them, right?
Yeah, and I didn't know any of them beforehand, you know, so I appreciate that they were willing to do that. And, you know, and I tried to tell their story really responsibly. But yeah, that they would open up to me about some of these things and tell me these inside stories, and that I could bring that to the fans, because even in the newspapers at the time, there wasn't a lot of that sort of stuff.
What do you think, just getting into what's going on now, are you excited for Belmont? Is that something that, now you did a book about the Nassau Coliseum.
Yeah.
You clearly hold this place special in your heart. To put that kind of time and dedication into a project like that, into a place like that, you probably have a different feeling than somebody like me, who also grew up there, going there since I was a child, but I'm completely done with the place, and I can't wait to get to Belmont Park. What do you think about Belmont, or do you, you know, it's happening. It's not happening, but did you still hold out the hope that, all right, we can get this done, we can find a way to get this to happen where we could stay over there on Hempstead Turnpike? You know, well, listen, they're going to be staying on Hempstead Turnpike also, just a little further down the line. But you know what I'm saying, being there in that spot.
Right. I know it's unrealistic at this point for them to come to Nassau Coliseum full time, probably. But of course, as I think most Islanders fans know, this is our only home until they went to the Barclays Center, which was just like this disgraceful period that we won't talk
about. But
they
had to do it.
Right.
Now, maybe 15 years from now, you can do a book about the 3-year saga of the Barclays Center. I've given you your next project, Nick. Thank you. I'll write the foreword for you. There you go.
Awesome.
We just did everything. Your next book, or yeah, your next book, because you'll do some other stuff, I'm sure, before then. But let some time go by. Let 15, 20 years go by. And then you, just like you did with this, and then here it is. What went on in the 3-year span that the Island, because they're not playing there next year. They're not going to play there next year.
I hope not.
I mean, they haven't announced it, but I can't imagine any way that they're going to play any more games after February 16th in that building. I just don't see it. There it is, Nick. the 3 to 4 year span of the Islanders at Barclays Center. Interview all the guys. Tell Tavares I said hi.
I was going
to
say,
talk to everybody in there, and there's your next book.
Yeah, no, and people have mentioned that as being this new crazy. Although I still don't think that the Barclays era is quite as wild as what happened in the mid-90s.
No. You're not matching this stuff.
Was great. But, yeah, I mean, I grew up going to the Nassau Coliseum. I love the energy there. I was there for the Sean Bates penalty shot goal in 2002.
I was, too.
To me, that was the best sports moment of my life, just to be there. And the angle of my seat was when he, you know, went in on Curtis Joseph, and I couldn't see whether the puck went in, just to hear all
you just heard everybody.
Yeah! And that was such an amazing atmosphere for that. And I've been there so many great playoff games, Al Arbor night, Bill Torrey night, all that kind of stuff. So any part, you know, just seeing them leaving Nassau Coliseum is going to be painful for me. I know that it probably makes sense. They need to have some sort of a basis of revenue. And I think that when they go to Belmont, at least, if they're owning the arena, if they can make the money from the concerts and the wrestling and the circuses and everything else that comes into the arena, then hopefully that'll work out.
Which was also a huge problem during the time period that you document in this book. They were not getting the revenue that a professional sports franchise needed during those times. They weren't getting it because SMG, the crooks that they were getting it all. So that hurts. It would be nice for them to just have their own home again. And even being here now, playing these games at the refurbished Coliseum, I don't consider it their home anymore. Like, when they left that day against the Capitals a couple years ago in that playoff game, that was it for me. Like, I closed the book that day on the Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum, and I know that they're still playing games there. I was there. I mean, we were both there. December 1st, I went. Even walking around it that night, outside it had the feel. The fans gave you the feel.
Mm-hmm.
But inside, it wasn't the same. I kind of felt like I was walking around Barclays Center, to be quite honest with you, because they modeled a lot of the concession areas and everything in there kind of looks like you're at Barclays.
Sure.
And that probably was part of it. What they did to the outside was part of it. It's not where we grew up going to games anymore. It's the same physical building, but it's not that place. And I'm kind of been looking forward for a long time. Even while they were still at the old Coliseum, we all wanted this, is for them to really, truly, and genuinely have their own home. And I think it's great that we're finally going to get that.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll come around when I go to Belmont. Right. If they have one good playoff series there, you know, that we'll start seeing fans come around to it. It was the same thing for me. I'm a Mets fan when they left for Citi Field.
Yeah.
I really hated it. I love Shea Stadium. Then, you know, you go there a few times, they make the World Series, they have the All-Star game there, you start saying, oh, there's some positive memories here.
They did a nice job. I like Citi Field a lot. I'm a Yankee guy, but I think that Citi Field's better than the new Yankee Stadium. I like it there. I think they did a nice job with the building. I think that they just kind of, they did some things wrong in the new Yankee Stadium, and I think the Mets did a nice job with Citi Field. But I understand that connection, because all you did as a kid was Shea Stadium.
Well,
that's
the one constant.
Especially
that's
being in Queens. I mean, had such a connection for you.
Well, and the Coliseum, for me, that was the one link to everything in Islanders history, right? That's the only consistent thing. Even the logo isn't consistent for this chapter in my book. So the one thing was, you could go to those games, think Mike Bossy was here. You know, Bobby Nystrom was here. These great memories, even going, you know, Billy Harris of the first games of the franchise. All through the lean periods. And so when they started winning again, for me, like, you know, the 2002 playoff series versus the Maple Leafs was that renaissance of the team and Yashin
that was
Pekka
the rebirth.
And Osgood.
Charles Wong taking over all that stuff.
And then having...
Amazingly, Milbury's still there.
Yeah, still there at that time. And then all of the, you know, the ins and outs and the low periods, but it just always felt like home because it's just like any other place that you go to so many times. There's the friendships that were formed there. There's different memories, whether they were terrible, you know, good. And there's still something just very special about that place. Now, they're going to move away from it. It's going to be sad for me to see. But hopefully there'll be a new generation.
Now they're revitalizing that whole area around it. So you could go there for anything now. And we're 20 years too late with
it's
that one too, right?
Yeah.
Here's the one that I thought of while I was reading the book. Do you think that if they didn't do what they did in 1994, rebranding. Let's say they never did that, the fisherman stuff and all that. Do you think that when they moved to Brooklyn, they would have that 100% they would have changed the logo, they would have changed everything?
I think that fisherman logo controversy has turned them so off from doing any dramatic changes to the jersey. So that's why
there was talk, because that was the fear, because they did it to the Nets when the Nets moved to Brooklyn, but it was a completely different story. They were moving out of to a different state. They were moving. That was a franchise that you talk about needed a rebranding.
Right.
The New Jersey Nets needed a rebranding.
And the Nets didn't have the history that the Islanders did of the four straight championships.
But when the talk and when Wong announced that they would be moving there, immediately the chatter was they're going to go like the Nets to the black and white, and they did make the thirds with the black and white. But people thought that that would be a permanent move, and the Barclays people, I could tell you, would have absolutely made it a permanent move if somebody didn't get in there. Probably Charles, because he probably heard it so many times in his life that you could never change the logo again. I think that if that fisherman stuff doesn't happen, when they move to Brooklyn, they're wearing black and white and wearing a completely different rebranding.
They probably would have changed. I wondered growing up, why are they always keeping the primary logo but just changing the background? Oh, now it's orange, now it's blue, now it's this thing.
You know what? You bring that up, and I'll piggyback off that, too. I think that if they would have kept the crest, the actual logo, and did everything else to the jersey like they did in the 96-97 season when they finally brought it back, but they still had the waves, the lighthouse on the shoulder, I think if they would have kept the original logo and just made those other changes around it, I think it would have been a lot more receptive.
Oh, sure.
Right? I mean, I
think there's lots of things. I think that if they had made the lighthouse the main logo and they put the fisherman even as the shoulder patch, I don't think it would have gotten that reaction.
Right.
Or the lighthouse is the main one, the original Islanders logo on the shoulder. Lots of things.
Didn't help that the Daily News sandbagged them either with that with that, too, which is in the book also, that the Daily News hit them with the fish stick stuff 2 or 3 months before the logo was even released.
Before they even unveiled it at a press
conference.
Which didn't
help things either.
So
that puts you behind the eight ball majorly.
So some of it was misfortune, right? I say, yes, a lot of this was penny pinching. A lot of this was just poor planning. But some of it was just things didn't work out the way that, you know, Kirk Muller should have shown up.
Right.
You know, we didn't think that Brett Lindros was going to get hurt the way he did.
It's everything else.
Yeah. So
it's like I said, that was like the main thing that I tied into it all. You did an unbelievable job with it is we all look at the logo as, you know, that symbol of it, but there was so much more reasons to be upset than the jersey.
Yeah.
They go and they have the kind of season that they had in 93, the first year that they wear those jerseys. They're never changing the jersey.
We're still wearing them today.
They're still wearing them. It was about that period, that dark period of Islander hockey, which is what everybody cannot stand. All right, we've been here forever. I'm holding you up for so long now.
Not at all.
Before we go, what do you think of the team now? Barry Trotz in there, Lou Lamoriello running the show, the other guy gone, Barzal the face of the team now. What do you think of this new Islander group that's playing right now?
I think you've got to love it. I mean, I think that what they missed for so long was having firm ownership, you know, someone who you could really be confident, which it seems like they finally have with Malkin and Ledecky, and then having plans for a real arena, which it seems like they've got that, and Cuomo's backing it. It's really going to happen. And then just to see the way that Lamoriello and Trotz run the team, the post-game press conferences, just it feels like finally we have someone in charge who knows what they're doing. It may not happen right away. We got to be patient, which Isles Twitter is not great at doing sometimes.
No. Can you imagine Twitter in 94?
I would. I'd love to see what the videos would have been like of like Niles in the stand. I would have footage.
We would have had all the footage of all the young kids whacking him.
That's what I think about all the time. But yeah, you know, you gotta love it. I mean, just going to some of the games, like you said, I went on December 1st. I was there at the Billy Joel night the other day. You know, yes, it's just seeing these young guys gel together, this right mix. I think you've got to be optimistic. I view it as like, you know, kind of like the Mets in 84, 85. Like they're starting to get things together. And on the horizon, you could see really good things happening.
No doubt about it. I think that there's, and it's about the coaching. The coaching has changed this team so much. They've gone from what they were last year into playing this defensive style of structure. And they're, you know, when they score 3 goals, they win. I mean, it's that simple. They're 14-2 coming in. They're playing Vegas tonight. We're taping this tonight. They're playing Vegas. They're 14-2, I believe, when they score 3 goals or more.
Yeah.
So they're playing a defensive style.
It's their just, goals against is, you know, it's radically changed.
It's crazy. And they've got a foundation still, and they've got some other pieces through the pipeline, whether it be Bellows or Dobson and Wahlstrom, other guys that are going to come through there. But the future's bright. They're going to have a new home, and they won't have a new logo when they go there.
We'll right, see Nick? About that. Or maybe if they do, then I'll have a new book in 20 years to write.
We know what the new book's going to be. We know already. I gave you the idea already, Nick. Come on. The book is We Want Fish Sticks, the bizarre and infamous rebranding of the New York Islanders. Nick Hirschhorn did an unbelievable job with it. Please, we've got a couple of days left before Christmas. Go out and get it. Amazon, I'm assuming, yep. Nick, right? You can get it there.
Get it on Amazon.
They're pretty quick with the... Get your Prime. You'll get it here by
and
the time.
And it's at a lot of the Barnes & Noble on Long Island. I've heard right. people saying that they're
did
going
you go
out
over,
and get it.
Did you go to the sign... What is the big place that you sign books over there in Huntington?
Oh, Book Review and Hunting. I've still got that coming
when
up.
When is that
January
coming up?
7th.
January 7th. You can go see Nick there. Anywhere else that you're going to be signing?
I'm going to be at the Offside Tavern. I believe it's December 29th. I'm going to be there.
Offside Tavern.
That's when they're playing JT and the Maple Leafs.
The first Maple Leaf game, my guy. Guys, Hockey Night in New York are doing a live show there that night. My boys Shawnee and Tony, they're doing their show there before the game that night.
That's right.
So go and check them out. I'll be doing my show there on February 23rd. Nick, come out and hang out.
Awesome.
On that night at the Offside Tavern, too. So I hope to see you there. Go out, see Nick, get a book. He'll sign it for you. Christmas is almost here. Go to Amazon. We Want Fish Sticks, the bizarre and infamous rebranding of the New York Islanders. Nick, I really enjoyed it. Thank you for giving me so much time tonight. I had a blast.
Thank you so much, Mike. I really appreciate it.
My thanks right there to Nick Hirschhorn, author of We Want Fish Sticks. Awesome chat. I had a lot of fun talking with Nick. So much to digest there. We said it all. Any feelings or any thoughts that you had on that period of Islander hockey, me and Nick hit it for you during that time period. So the Islanders fall in Vegas tonight, 4-2 to the Golden Knights. It was their third road game in four nights, and it showed to me. It definitely showed. Played okay in the first, but then I got dominated pretty much the rest of the game. A couple of really pretty goals in the first period by Barzal and Brock Nelson. The toe drag by Brock there. How about that? More praise for Brock. We've had a lot of that here tonight, and well-deserved. He's been playing very well. Picked it back up. Usually, when he goes into one of those ruts, he never comes back out of it. He had a little bit of one in the end of November, early December. He's climbed back out. He's scored in a couple games now. Good to see from Brock. The Barzal goal was really nice as well. But second period, they got absolutely flooded. Vegas was all over them. Third period, more of the same to me. And they got caught in a situation where Vegas got a couple of quick goals. A 2-1 game becomes a 3-2 game. Isles had a late power play. The Boychuk hit ended up being a 4-on-4 somehow. I don't really know. Refs were bad tonight. Refs have been bad all week. But it's hard for me to get on the refs tonight against Vegas when the team was outplayed. And that's going to happen when you play three road games in four nights. This still has the opportunity to be a very successful trip for the Islanders. You take this, and then you go down to Dallas on Sunday. If you can get a win there, take 3 out of 4 on this trip, that's a really strong road trip coming out west for the Isles. We'll see if they can do that. They'll probably have Devontae's in the lineup on Sunday against Dallas. That should be good to see. That'll excite some people on Sunday night. And going for a 3 out of 4 road trip, that's pretty good as well, too. And then they get a little bit of a break. The Christmas holiday comes up before they go home to take on the Ottawa Senators on Friday night at the Barclays Center as we continue to count down those dates that are left before they get out of there. And then Saturday night in Toronto, first meeting between the Islanders and John Tavares. It is a road one up there. The real first meeting will be when he comes to the Coliseum in late February. That's the one we have circled. But still, seeing Johnny for the first time, that will happen next week. If you're not doing anything, the guys from Hockey Night in New York are going to be out at the Offside Tavern. They're having a little pre-show. Nick Hirschhorn, like he just told you, is going to be there as well, signing copies of the book. So plenty going on at the Offside Tavern for the first night of the Islanders against John Tavares. So if you can find your way out there, please do it. My thanks once again to Nick Hirschhorn for coming on tonight. My thanks to you guys for listening as always. Everybody have a safe, happy, and healthy holiday. Christmas, New Year's, the whole deal. My thanks as always to the sponsors, 3J's Auto and Customs, Santorini Restaurant, Oakwood Automation, Bright Building Services. They take care of us. Please take care of them. I will talk to you guys next week or the week after the I'll See Podcast, Mike Carver. We'll see you next time.